Now, 5 on 5, 5 on Radio RTE.ie. Bob says, to some, the puka looks like the devil. There's the problem. And on the census, I remember a census cartoon from my youth. Two men talking, one says to the other, not filled in the form. Have you taken leave of your senses? Hey! Sorry. Terrible puns. Now, I'm joined in studio by Anne Higgins. And Anne is the new school principal in Temple Street Children's Hospital. Good afternoon, Anne.
Good afternoon, Ray.
I'd say a lot of people are going, huh? I didn't know there was a school.
Exactly.
It's a hospital, not a school.
Exactly.
Now, we'll get to all of that. But I'm going to quote you back to yourself to get us started, because you had said about this job, as in the principal in Temple Street Children's Hospital School, that if it ever came up, you said to some of your colleagues, don't go near it. Because that's mine.
I've
manifested that and it's mine.
You may as well not apply for it. Yeah. I'm getting that job.
You're getting that job. And you did.
I did.
So you feel very, very strongly about it.
I do.
And you've been guided towards it. So go on.
100%.
Yeah.
Temple Street is very close to my heart. We can talk about Michael quite a lot. So many people will remember Michael, and we can talk about that. But since all through Michael's life, we were in and out of Temple Street constantly.
So I suppose at this stage, since you've brought up Michael straight away, I better just let people know. So back in 2015 or thereabouts, you and your husband Barry,
that's right,
and Michael, who is your foster child,
yes,
featured on Room to Improve.
We did.
And Michael was a wheelchair user.
That's right.
And he stole the heart of the nation.
He did.
Yeah.
And rightly so.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Fancy dancing.
So people remember him. And then he featured on The Late Late Show. And he died then in 2018.
He did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're heartbroken.
Heartbroken.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So you would have been in and out of Temple Street with Michael.
Over the years. So as soon as we got involved with Michael, which was around about age 7, anytime he had appointments in Temple Street, he really wanted us to bring him. He needed that, you know, mum and dad comfort with him in Temple Street. He had a condition called osteogenesis imperfecta, which is commonly known as brittle bone disease. It's a lot more complex than just brittle bones. But he had very regular treatments, unfortunately very regular fractures, and also just other appointments. So we were in and out of there. It was our second home. And I was blown away by, I suppose, how much love was given to him, but also how much love he had for Temple Street. At times before he lived with us, when he lived in residential care, I think he preferred staying in Temple Street, and he'd be trying to beg doctors and nurses, go on, let me stay another night, which is very unusual for a child in a hospital setting. So we have built up, I mean, when Michael was 7, that's back to 2009. So my relationship with Temple Street goes back quite a long way.
Of course, people remember him as this amazingly gregarious
12-year-old.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
And I can see why in the hospital setting he would have been a bit of a star, I'd imagine, wasn't he?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Oh, yeah, ruling the roost in there.
Yeah.
And what's lovely is he's still so well remembered in there, and I think he's in many ways, still guiding people. And I'm told that there's photographs of Michael around the place. They're still very much guided by Michael in there. So people are asking, we all know John Doyle, the porter in Temple Street, and he will say, yeah, if I run it past Michael in the morning and I say to him, well, if it's, you know, I'm going to do it for you, and then it'll be the right thing to do.
Ah, that's lovely, isn't
it? But he had that effect on
so
people.
He's guided you to your job.
He has guided me to my job. And that might sound strange to some people, but I think anybody who's lost anybody, you know, very close to them, but especially a child, you know, he lives in my heart. I feel him. I genuinely do feel him. I have had very strange and unusual things happen along the way that can only be explained by Michael.
Go on.
Oh, there's so many examples. There's a couple of songs, of course, that'll come up, but they'll come up at a time when I've actually asked him to let me know he's around me. And they aren't songs that maybe you would hear, generally speaking, on the radio. I've been in cafes when I've been upset and having a cup of coffee and thinking about him, and a song will come on and going, well, that's Michael. Down to finding things on the side of the road that, you know, you think that's a very strange thing for me to find right now. And I'm not talking about the feathers or I'm not talking about the robins. I'm talking about things. For example, Michael made up his own sayings. He had Michaelisms. His friends, if they're listening today, they'll be roaring laughing because they didn't make sense, but they were hilarious. And his favourite one was, because he was a very hot little creature, and his favourite saying was, geez, I'm sweating like a dolphin. Right. And who knows what dolphins sweat like, but he was sweating like one. And we were away we ran away to Spain about a week after Michael died. We just needed to run out of the country and be on our own. And we were in a town square in Marbella. And there was one of those mime artists. And Barry, being the big softy that he is, said, I feel sorry for those fellas. They're standing there in the heat and they're trying to, nobody goes, I'm going to go and give him a couple of euro. And he handed the guy a couple of euro, and the guy grabbed his hand and put something in it, and he closed his hand. Barry came back down and sat at the table, and it was a dolphin.
No way.
Yeah, and there's been lots of those sort of dolphin things that have happened. So, yeah, it's very upsetting, but it's also comforting.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's so because it's like, did you not feel a little bit spooked by that?
Not really,
no.
Because it's him.
Right.
So not because it's Michael, no.
Let's go back then to your relationship with Michael and how it started. So he was in residential care.
He was.
And you were a teacher.
I was a teacher in the same building. So there was it was a hospital school. It's no longer a hospital school, but at the time the locals in Baldoyle would have called it Little Willie's, St Mary's Hospital. And that's where Michael lived from when he was a baby and came down to school when he was 3 years of age. This tiny, tiny little mite that just whispered. You could barely just whisper. You couldn't hear him at all. And to see him years later on the stage in the Helix Theatre, giving it socks, belting out songs, was just an incredible feat. It showed what inner resilience and strength he had. Mm. So when Michael was in my class, I fell in love with him immediately. I think a lot of people did. But I sort of vowed to do something. I felt the school wasn't the right placement for him. So I made a promise to him without him knowing that the first thing I was going to do was move him to a school that was more suitable. So we did that. And then on his 8th birthday, he had a party, and that was when Barry met him. And that's when everything changed.
Barry's your husband.
Barry's my husband.
Big softy.
Big softy. He loved that. Although he's a big hard man.
No, but I was re-watching Room to Improve. And every time you went to talk about anything slightly emotional.
He's a bit emotional.
He had to get up and walk away because he didn't want to... cry on television. Yeah.
I know, he is a softie. He's great.
Yeah. So Barry fell in love as well.
Barry fell in love with Michael. Barry'd heard all about Michael, and he was fascinated because Michael was in this house at a party, and all he was doing was Anne. And he was just, Barry was, and we left the house that day, and Barry's words to me were, we have to do something. And I went, uh-oh. But sure, I was delighted, but it had to be the two of us together. So, we set the wheels in motion, and it started off with us being allowed to take Michael out for, a day trip out into town and have the crack. But over time, I mean, it went from, oh, Michael, we might do it once every 2 weeks to there was no way that was happening. It was happening every week.
Yes.
And then it became, can I not stay the night with you? Because he didn't really want to go back to where he was staying. He wanted to stay with us. So.
And he was loved by
both. Oh, sure. We adored him.
And it was that. So it was one night, and then he'd stay two nights. That was
a doubler. That was the doubler, yeah. Yes. And we sort of gently sort of moved the goalposts a wee bit and liaised with both the residential services that he was with and with his biological family. And over time, I suppose Michael learned to be very, very, very well spoken. And he would, very well good at speaking up for himself.
Oh, yes, yes.
He hadn't been previously. He was quite timid and I suppose nervous. And he had grown up in a setting where he didn't have a core family network around him. And he had just grown so, so good at speaking up for himself. And I think Michael made the decision. He just said, well, I want to live with you. And we're like, well, we want you here. So let's go and do something about it. And that was it. We changed everything.
And when we all were introduced to you and Michael in 2015 through Room to Improve, was he permanent fixture in the house at that stage?
Not at that stage. No. So that was a huge stepping stone. So at that stage, he had definitely moved on to trebles.
Right.
and every so often during school holidays, we might have snuck in another day or two. But we were very much still bringing the mattress downstairs into the sitting room. And we were all sleeping in the one room because he wouldn't let us leave him. And it wasn't ideal. The wheelchair barely fit through the front door. So we were, it was all meant to be. And I do believe even that was meant to be, that Room to Improve came along and did such a phenomenal job for us. Yeah. As we were watching the current series, on a very tight budget.
And there's a great line in it where Michael delivers the, because he delivered the line, what's the budget? And he said, 130,000. Yeah. 130,000 was the budget.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you ever watch that back?
Not really. I find it quite hard to. If I feel like wanting to have a great old big cry, I think watching Michael's videos of him on anything, whether it's singing in the Helix or Room to Improve or when he was on RT or his own videos that I have on the phone and listening to his voice, I find listening to his voice just, you know, it's so emotional for me to listen to his voice. Yeah, it is. But I mean, I love it still, but I have to be ready. I have to be ready and sit down and make a decision to do that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So it's 4 years on then.
Four years this May, yeah.
So he would have been living permanently with you, you and Barry, for how long? How many years? Two or 3 years?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So you were a family unit.
Oh, completely. I mean, you know, thank God we did all the brilliant things. Like, we had a massive party for him when he moved in. And, you know, he couldn't believe it himself. He was actually interviewed by an American guy who runs a YouTube channel called Special Books for Special Children. And he was doing, Michael and myself used to watch the videos, and he was doing a tour of Ireland. And he said, I'm looking for Irish families. And again, we put our names in. And we were the only family picked. Like, it was all sort of meant to be, kismet or whatever you call it. So they came to our house, and now that is the most treasured video that we have, is that video clip of Michael being interviewed, because he did it in my absence. I had to sit in the other room, and it was so honest.
Like,
was,
what sort of questions was he
I suppose
asked?
They asked Michael how he felt about living with us, and of course that was very honest. And he was things like, I can't actually believe it's come, my wishes have come true, my dreams have come true. And he was asked what was it like for him growing up in residential care, and he was very measured, and he just stopped and his face changed and he said, it wasn't the best.
Yeah.
And that was enough to be said, because Michael, you know, he had such a positive outlook in life. He didn't go there. He didn't go backwards. He didn't hold anything against anybody. He knew who his people were. He knew his tribe. He knew who he could trust. He could read your face. And if you smiled, but you didn't mean it, he would know straight away. Because he'd say to me, that person has a smile, but they don't seem happy.
You sort of, maybe that's a skill you have to develop.
Yeah.
When you're brought up in residential care.
That's exactly
who you can
it,
trust
Ray.
And who you...
You do. You have to read people. Yeah. And on top of that, if you have a very significant physical disability and you can't get yourself up away from people, you can't run away, you can't fight your own corner physically or any other way. And his condition was such that he had to be lifted very carefully by people. And if he wasn't lifted carefully, he'd break a bone. So he was very... very nervous of people, and there was a key.
So he had to get the measure of people so he could trust them.
He had a core group of unbelievable carers at that time, who some of whom I'm still in touch with, and they were his people at that time.
He died, was it quickly in the end? Or?
Unfortunately, Michael had an accident, and that was on the 16th of March, 4 years ago. So we're actually that time. And he was in ICU then for 7 weeks. So that was a horrendous time.
Oh, God.
But again, his true fighting spirit, he fought and fought and fought. So we lived in Temple Street, and that's where the relationship between ourselves, I suppose, the care Michael got during that time, it was always brilliant, but we saw a whole other side of Temple Street up in ICU and the care they gave. We lived in the hospital, we had a room in the hospital, we never went home. So they became our family.
Yeah.
So you can see where the strength of my relationship is with them. And
sort of, you feel, I suppose you feel like you owe them in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just feel part of them too.
Yeah.
And I feel and closer to him in
there. Yeah, but that's the thing. Yeah, and some people say that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah, no, I do.
So you're going into work then. And
I'm going into
constant
work.
Reminders of, of Michael there.
Yeah. So there's I'm only started last Monday week.
Right.
So there are a certain few pathways in the hospital that are a little bit triggering for me at the moment. So I'm taking them for the first time.
Okay.
And they can be a little bit challenging and certainly trigger points, but I'm aware of it. And I wouldn't have taken the job, unless I felt I could manage and get through that.
And how has it been for you and Barry the 4 years?
I think the first year, 2 years have probably been in a bit of a blur. I went back to my own job. I was a school principal previously and I just went back and stuck my head into work. And I don't think I really gave myself time to grieve properly. I didn't take time out really. I think a lot of parents who grieve will do that. You just get on with, dust yourself off and almost don't go there. But it does, unfortunately, it will catch up with you at some point. But we've minded each other in that, and we've good family and good friends around us. But it's very sad, and the house is terribly quiet because we've built the house for Michael.
Well, when I was watching it back, that was the heartbreaking thing. Because you built it for him.
Every single thing that went into that house was considered for turning points for wheelchairs and for access to countertops.
The table was bespoke.
Everything in his bedroom. It was, now I suppose we still feel very strongly attached to him in the house, but it's so quiet. I mean, I suppose we're used to it now, but in the first few months it was, I actually sat in the garden. We were lucky we had a good summer in May 2018 and I sat in the garden, and I mean morning, noon and night, I sat in the garden because the house was too quiet, because I couldn't hear the whirring of his wheelchair, the clicking of the joystick of his chair, and of course, most of all, him shouting and roaring. And his pals, his best buddies, who I think Michael hit the teenage years like any teenager, and he went from what the nation would have seen, the 12 or 13 year old wanting to sit on my lap every evening, of course you can. And then all of a sudden he was gone. He was in the room, the door was closed, the music was on, the singing was happening, and he was full steam ahead with the six Egypts. So they had a WhatsApp group or a FaceTime group or something. And the six Egypts were on the phone every night and the crack. And Michael was always the designated DJ. So you can imagine the noise level.
What songs was he? I know he was into One Direction at that. That was
One Direction at that time Ed Sheeran. But you name it. I mean, whatever was current at the time was Michael sang. Yeah. He had an uncanny ability to listen to a song probably twice and he could sing the whole thing.
Right.
And he had a beautiful voice.
So he'd be delighted, that you're a school principal in Temple Street now. It's how many teachers are there?
There's five teachers in Temple Street, and there's two SNAs and a school secretary. We can't forget her. And a wonderful school. As I said, I'm only in the door. They've been so welcoming.
And is there an actual school?
So there's a school office and like a teacher's meeting staff room, resource room, and a large classroom. And they're in one central place in the hospital. And then there's two satellite classrooms on the end of two of the wards. So teachers, come in the morning, gather, and then they'll have a look and see the admissions. Somebody said to me, it's almost like looking at the admissions in the hotel,
see
who went
in.
Came. And obviously there's a lot of predictability with some children
who are repeat
customers.
Yes,
Children are in and out a lot for things like hemodialysis, and there's other children that'll be there for long stays and they'll be priority for teaching. And then
there's a lot of one-on-one then, is there?
Oh, lots of one-on-one, especially since COVID. The teachers would have taken children in small groups to the classroom, but at the moment that's not possible. Yeah. And that would be amazing if we could get back to that.
It's a specific type of teaching.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that requires a specific type of person.
They're magic. It wouldn't be for everybody. And obviously, post-primary teachers are sometimes obliged. They're trying to cover junior cycle subjects and children might be preparing for exams and might be feeling very anxious that they're missing out. So those teachers would link closely with the child's base school at home. And then for a lot of the other children, the teachers just spend a lot of time at first getting to know the children and seeing what do they like, what do they enjoy, and start there. start at the end of the day, they're sick.
The last thing you want to put them under is pressure, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Look, their medical needs come first. That's priority first and foremost.
Now, Niamh has been on here. She says, myself, my daughter met Michael in Temple Street one Stephen's Day morning. And even though she was older than him, he comforted her. She met him again in the CRC when on work placement and told him the story, and he was delighted. That's Niamh. And I knew Michael. I was one of his nurses in CRC. He was the life and soul of the place. He was one of the most beautiful people I ever met.
There you go.
A little devil in his own way, but once met, never forgotten. Anne and Barry were just the best, says Siobhan. And please pass on my very good wish to Anne Higgins. Anne was a teacher to my son Darren in special school in Baldoyle many years ago before she became principal there. She was fantastic to everyone. We remember Michael. And that's from Rosaline and Jonathan Egan.
Yeah.
So it's just, and I know it's difficult, but he was obviously a very special teenager.
He really was.
And he had an effect on people. He touched people when he met them.
He really did. Yeah. He really, nobody can explain it, but I'm so glad that we discovered it. And I'm so glad that we enabled him to come out of his shell. Because he was in a shell for a long time, very quiet and reserved. And I'm so glad that we gave him the opportunity to actually blossomed. Mm. And to see that strength and resilience and energy and love for life. I mean, I tell people this all the time. They'd be bored listening to me. But, you know, not many people wake up in the morning giddy with excitement when there's actually nothing happening. And we would look at him and say, why are you so excited? He says, I'm just excited for my life. I mean, if we can all live by that.
Oh, yeah. Let's take a leaf out of Michael's book. That's the perfect way to end our chat. Thanks so much for coming in. And good luck in the new job.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me Michael with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.